Hello, and welcome to the Alterity and Western Art Music Podcast. I'm Justin.
And I'm Drew. If we sound weird, it's because we're recording with masks on.
So this is a project conceived by a group of musicology graduate students studying music and alterity at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, in the wake of the civil and political unrest sweeping the United States in 2020.
This podcast seeks to contribute to the recent wave of critical commentary within the field of musicology, which shows that racist practices continually plague the academic and musicological community. These observations include Dr. Philip Ewell's condemnation of music theory's white racial frame and Dr. Danielle Brown's open letter on racism in music studies. You can find links to both texts in the syllabus that accompanies and expands on this podcast.
While we would like to say that the response to these arguments within scholarship were civil and met with reform, one academic journal, the Journal of Schenkerian Studies, published inflammatory responses to Dr. Ewell's words, responses that were often fraught with racist undertones. These critiques and their responses have become especially salient amidst the 2020 surge in the Black Lives Matter movement.
As a group of graduate students at a major research institution, we recognize our privileged positions in speaking about systemic issues such as racism and prejudice, issues that extend well beyond the confines of the ivory tower. Nonetheless, if the conflicts surrounding the Confederate monument known as Silent Sam at our home institution are any indicator, these systemic issues are far from absent from the ivory tower.
In other words, musicology and academia more broadly are not bubbles outside of the world. But as a group of students within these fields, the best we can do is speak to those issues closest to us. This is what drove us to conceive of this project, one that examines the concept of alterity in Western art music, musicology, how this can reveal injustices inflicted by scholars in the past, and how we can improve these discourses in the future.
One of these injustices, hinted at in the works of Dr. Ewell and Dr. Brown, is that musicology, music history, and music criticism have a long and devious history of being vehicles for ideologies of racism and control. We hope to show that as far back as the 19th century, writings about music have been utilized to promote agendas of settler colonialism and white supremacy. While this is not uncommon in the history of America, many U.S. institutions are built upon and continue this ideation without reflection upon what it promotes and fails to see the errors of the past.
To reference one of the rallying cries of the Black Lives Matter movement, silence is violence. One of the ways that these injustices have been perpetuated in musicology and Western art music until recently is through a lack or even refusal of self-examination. As a podcast directed both at our field, but more importantly, at audiences beyond the ivory tower, we hope to take just one small step in the direction of addressing such problematic narratives.
We begin this episode, the first in a three-episode series, by answering two questions. What is alterity? And what does it have to do with Western art music, otherwise known as classical music? In the second half, we apply this concept to the music of the Czech composer Antonín Dvořák.
So when we say alterity, what we mean is otherness, something that exists outside of yourself and you don't understand, something that is particularly different from yourself, which includes other people.
So why use this word alterity rather than something simpler like difference? What defines alterity and sets it aside from recognizing difference?
We asked this question of Dr. Annegret Falzer, a musicologist who has done research in the field of music and alterity.
Alterity is a word that philosophers use to understand how an individual connects to their environment, the world around them, what they see, what they hear, what they experience. People understand this as being outside of themselves, something that is not them. And so to capture this complex relationship between an individual and their environment, the word alterity captures, if you want, that really complicated relationship. When we use a word like difference or this is other, then we are more specific. We are pointing out something that is characteristic. It's a quality judgment, not, if you want, a structural description.
In philosophy, the concept of alterity has its roots in French thought, often related to the work of Emmanuel Levinas. Levinas says that ethically, we have an obligation to help and protect this unknowable other at the expense of ourselves. That the way to find meaning and understanding is through an interaction where we give wholly of ourselves to the other, solely for the other's benefit.
While this is impossible, what Levinas hints at is that we have an ethical duty to help other people, especially if they are wholly different from us, in order to work for a better future that exists beyond our own lifespan.
So alterity has been around, some would say, for more than 2,000 years when Plato started to try and figure things out in the cave. But really, alterity as the way in which we, in the way we are now speaking about alterity, has to do with phenomenologists trying really to understand how we perceive the world, how we are cognitively connecting to the world. It starts around Nietzsche as one of the first figures who really got into it, but the one name most people would associate with alterity as a philosophical concept is Immanuel Levinas. Building on him, you have feminists such as Simone de Beauvoir, who's trying to figure out how it works. You have post-colonial scholars such as Homi Bhabha, who try and retool the term for post-colonial theory, where otherness becomes a political and social state of oppression in discourse.
So what does this have to do with classical music?
With classical music? It has a lot to do with classical music. For example, many composers were looking elsewhere for inspiration. So they were actually incorporating other people's traditions. And to think about what this means, the concept of alterity offers a framework within which to think what not just the music might be, but also what the price it might be to take someone else's stuff, to use a simple word. But alterity in music can go even further. What if a musician doesn't actually fit this concept of a self? A woman composer, a composer of color, a performer who also composes rather than, for example, just what we stereotypically associate with the genius. What if a composer themselves is an other and identifies as such and then connects with other others? So thinking about alterity allows us a way in to approach such very complicated forms of soundscapes.
In other words, there are often certain identities associated with classical music. Depending on your familiarity with this music, maybe you associate it with a bunch of rich old white people in tuxedos. Or maybe you think of a few transcendent composer geniuses like Mozart or Beethoven, whose music may or may not make your baby smarter.
These are exactly the kind of narratives we are working against when discussing Western art, music, and alterity. That classical music is the work of a select few great men with universalist appeal to be enjoyed by an elite audience with refined taste, most of whom just so happen to be white and wealthy.
It is our opinion that the art music history and musicology we teach today is still cloaked in the European and white U.S. American colonial language and imperialist ideologies of the 19th century. This narrative perpetuates hegemonic structures of race, sex, and socioeconomic status that restrict economic and academic resources for those considered the other within those structures.
To combat this, we will provide a series of case studies focusing on alterity from the late 19th through early 20th centuries in Western art music.
In these case studies, we seek to identify problematic narratives still persistent in histories of art music today, in musicology and beyond, and ultimately resist them.
One of these problematic narratives highlighted above is that of the genius composer, that there were a few great musical minds whose music transcends issues of race, gender, politics, etc. However, all of these composers fit the hegemonic structure that they are situated within, that being white, male, and European.
In our first case study, we seek to analyze one of these narratives in the case of Antonín Dvořák in his much-played New World Symphony.
Dvořák came to America in the summer of 1892 to run Jeanette Thurber's National Conservatory as its director. His arrival was highly anticipated by the American classical music community, claiming that he could be the composer who would define an American orchestral sound.
Before coming to America, Dvořák became famous as a Czech composer whose compositions utilized Czech folk melodies. His Slavonic Rhapsody, for instance, was celebrated for supposedly uplifting these folk melodies to serious European art. The expectation for his time in America was that he would elevate American folk melodies to the same standard and define America's national music.
Dvořák attempted to fulfill these expectations with his Symphony No. 9 in E minor, subtitled From the New World. His American sound took inspiration from African-American spirituals and themes meant to evoke the sound of Native Americans.
Many immediately hailed the symphony as a masterpiece. Yet a portion of the art music community decried that the New World Symphony couldn't possibly be considered American due to its Czechness and therefore lack of Americanness. These opinions were often fraught with racist undertones, clamoring that no one could consider the primitive musics of African Americans and Native Americans as the true folk music of the nation.
This last set of opinions perpetuated a white supremacist ideal that would culminate in the early 20th century, and that would inevitably inform and pervade music studies today, although in a less explicit way.
As musicologist Doug Shadle has suggested, Dvorak's sympathies with Native Americans and African Americans may have been related to his own feelings of being an outsider not only in the U.S., but as a Czech in his home country of Austria-Hungary. Nonetheless, his use of music of the other is highly consistent with that of an imperialist, integrating exotic sounds into the framework of so-called serious European art music.
Dvorak's position on the use of quote-unquote Negro melodies was well established in a famous interview he did with the Chicago Tribune, where he stated,
"I am now satisfied that the future music of this country must be founded upon what are called Negro melodies. This must be the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States."
This assertion inspired both racist and apologetic responses in the American press, claiming that the Czech composer was confused about the origin of the music he was consulting.
Dvořák later clarified upon his words in the Tribune, stating,
"I do not mean to take these melodies, plantation, Creole, or Southern, and work them out as themes. That is not my plan. But I study certain melodies until I become thoroughly imbued with their characteristics. My new symphony is an endeavor to portray characteristics such as are distinctively American."
Rather than promoting the music of Black and Native Americans, Dvořák essentially creates an illusion of their music in the soundscape of his symphony, one that fits a Western art imagination of those musics.
Upon closer examination of the history surrounding Dvořák's time in the U.S. and the music within the New World Symphony reveals that his utilization of spirituals and Native American melodies are less fact and more fiction. A famous section of the symphony's second movement, Largo, harkens a Southern spiritual aesthetic.
The issue with calling this theme a spiritual is that it isn't one, at least not before the symphony's 1893 premiere. Dvorak composed the melody himself and imbued it with the characteristics, to use his own words, of the spirituals sung to Dvorak by his black composition student, Harry Thacker Burley. It was only in 1922 that this melody was arranged as a song and given words by another Dvorak student, William Arms Fisher, who also happened to be white.
Despite being completely fabricated by a white Central European, the spiritual Going Home did enter the spiritual repertoire to some extent. The piece was a regular in the repertoire of African-American-based baritone and activist Paul Leroy Robeson, who consciously gave up performing European opera in 1934.
Much more explicitly exoticist and white supremacist approach, however, can be found in Dvorak's treatment of so-called Native American musics. The third movement, and possibly sections of the other movements, was supposedly inspired by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, The Song of Hiawatha. Dvorak's time in the U.S. was limited, and the closest he could have gotten to interacting with actual Native American music would have been in Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, a vaudeville show that hired Native Americans to portray stereotyped savages in a romanticized portrayal of the American West.
Thus, the so-called Native American influence in the New World Symphony is based on a poem by a white American author and a vaudeville show put together by white impresarios exploiting Native Americans, leaving Dvorak without having ever actually encountered Native American culture. The unchecked stereotypes and lack of cultural understanding leaves a legacy of white supremacy in the New World Symphony's approach to alterity.
Despite all the evidence we've presented to the contrary, the symphony today is often still described in music education and history textbooks as utilizing Native American themes and African American spirituals. This phenomenon of an imaginary musical lineage has been theorized by musicologist Dr. Nina Eichheim as a phantom genealogy. A phantom genealogy occurs when a historical political moment shapes the perception of the other in the future. In this case, the idea that Dvorak used music from the Black spiritual tradition, as well as Native American melodies, created a sonic expectation for music in the future, one that wore an exoticist mask.
What does this mean for alterity in Western art music? When it comes to American compositional style in the late 19th and 20th centuries, Dvorak set the standard for how to treat an idealized other in music. The responses to his symphony spanned the spectrum of rhetoric, praising its liberal ideas, citing its foreignness, and condemning the notion of using non-European music in high art. However, it set the precedent for how American composers appropriated music that stereotypes a non-European other.